Sequential tables.
Couldn't move, so. All right. Make this seat.
Good morning. My name is Richard Wooster, Matt Johnson Wooster, McLaughlin, Tacoma, Washington. And I'm here representing Roger Atkins and John Peel in this matter. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves to what extent is the Labor Management Relations Act surrendered to the collective, the individual right to force society's established standards for workplace behavior and seek redress for individual harm to the employee. Modern union organization exists primarily for the union organization. The relationship between the union and the employer subjugates individual workers to the status of dues paying human capital, whose rights are frequently overlooked when it is expensive or inconvenient or subordinated to the collective interest of all the employees in the bargaining unit. Wrongful discharge cases vindicate the public interest when the employer acts contrary to fundamental public policy and is called to task for that breach of acceptable behavior by the victimized employee. The individual's vigilance toward infringements upon his own rights is generally keener than that of the collective or a government agency. This court should uphold the principle that the rights to be free from wrongful dismissal in violation of Washington State public policy is an inalienable individual right that is not extinguished by the collective bargaining agreement. And the court should preserve the rule that oversight in matters of public importance remain with the court and are not divested by the process of a collective bargaining agreement.
Let me see if I can understand this correctly in the context of your opening. These individuals were terminated, correct?
That is correct.
And the reason for their termination had to do with claim filling out of the overtime and their pay records, correct?
That was what the employer asserted, and the employee's position was that they were asserting their rights under the Washington
Correct. Administration. I mean, there was a dispute. They felt that, given the work that they had done, that those were appropriate entries to be made. But when that went up on appeal, their termination was reversed. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's correct.
So in other words, the termination was found to have been wrongful, and therefore shouldn't have happened.
That's correct. There is found that the employer lacked just cause
correct.
For termination. And rather than an appeal, it was in the grievance arbitration. I guess it would be a grievance arbitration appeal. And it was in that process. It actually involves three layers. They were not awarded back pay.
Because they had concluded that your clients had behaved badly.
Well,
in fact, the judge said, I think they said, did not behave well.
Did not behave well.
I think that's exactly what the arbitrator said. However, you have to look at it in view of the context in which the case was presented in arbitration by the union. The union made a tactical decision, whether it was for the benefit of Mr. Atkins and Mr. Peel or for the benefit of the union, that they would present no evidence on the employer's case. The employer presented their case that Mr. Atkins and Mr. Peel had engaged in terminable behavior, and the union rested at the end of the employer's case, never put any evidence on whatsoever, never allowed Mr. Atkins and Mr. Peel an opportunity to go forward and tell their side of the story.
But just to put it in, we're trying to get the procedure straight. So they won half a loaf at the arbitration appeal. The termination was not for just cause.
And they were reinstated.
And they were reinstated, but they didn't get any back pay or other money.
Correct.
So leaving aside now the other lawsuit which was filed, the lawsuit you've now filed that's on appeal is basically for the same termination that was already gone through arbitration. Is that correct?
That is correct, but it is on a different legal theory. It is that they were terminated in violation of the public policy of the state of Washington that employees should not be retaliated against for opposing employer practices which paid substandard wages.
You're a lawyer. You know that customarily, if you bring a claim and you lose, you're not allowed to bring the same claim again with a different legal theory. You bring it all at the same time. Why shouldn't that apply here?
Well, it shouldn't apply here, at least as it relates to the collective bargaining agreement, because the arbitrator had no authority to hear Mr. Atkins and Mr. Peel's public policy claim.
Now that, okay, so
that's
if let's
his,
just, do you want to wait just a minute? Let's just say that we agree with you on that point, that the arbitrator, because of their constrained authority, can't make a judgment on a public policy claim. And then you came to the district court and then on up to this court. But isn't the question here that between the time the arbitration finished and you filed your new suit, there was this intervening suit, and in that suit there was a release of claims? Isn't that really what makes this case different than a typical case of when we would be deciding whether or not there's public policy jurisdiction?
Well, it's a little bit more muddled than that.
Okay.
With regard to that, first, the case is in federal district court under removal under the Labor Management Relations Act 301 preemption provisions. And so in order to reach the question of whether or not the release knocks this claim out, first the court has to have jurisdiction. If the court has jurisdiction, then I suppose they could reach the pendant issue of is the claim knocked out by the language of the release. And I would submit that the language of the release is specifically limited by the trial counsel who had handled the matter below by referring it to only the wage and hour claims. And the case authority is set forth in the brief that parties can release limited aspects of their claim. Now, there is...
Okay, but here's the language. This is where it gets stuck. They have this litigation over overtime and work hours. But here's the release they signed. All claims, liabilities, or obligations which she or he has, or which might have arisen out of or in connection with plaintiff's employment at Praxair, that are based on state or federal law, including but not limited to, and then they go on and tell you some things. So it's all
including a specific reference to the Washington statute.
Statutes, but it's all claims that might have arisen out of their employment, and it included all claims up to that point that had been or could have been brought related to their employment. So the question is, why wouldn't that, and that's not an atypical release in litigation, not everybody signs them, but why wouldn't that be a release of all claims, whether public policy or not?
Okay, the reason why it is not a release of all of the claims is that language appears in the language under the paragraph titled No Admission of Fault or Liability. And under the doctrine of sui generis.
I think she was reading from a paragraph. I was following it that begins titled Release and Discharge. Am I looking at the wrong document? Or?
Yeah, that's where I was as well.
There's Release and Discharge, which is paragraph Roman number one of the agreement.
I think we may be on different documents. I'm looking at something that's identified as excerpts of record, page 73, entitled Settlement Agreement. And on the bottom of that page, there's a paragraph, Roman 1, Release and Discharge.
Are we looking at the one settlement agreement? That's the only one that
okay, Release and Discharge, 73.
And then the language he was reading came from page 74.
73 moves on to page 74.
Well, that language is further modified by the statement as you go on.
So it's the same document.
It is the same document, yes. It is modified by the statement um, related to wages or hours of work.
Where does it say that?
It says...
It says including but not limited to. And so it's not restricted by. In other words, it says all claims arising out of your employment, including but not limited to, and then it lists a bunch of statutes. And it also lists the DL, Department of Labor and Industries, related to wages or hours of work, including without limitation, and it talks about the various arrangements that truck drivers have in terms of breaks and that sort of thing. So, unless we were to read that language as limiting the release of all claims, which it doesn't seem to, I'm having trouble understanding why this isn't a release of all claims.
Well, the language that it is related to wages and hours of work, which includes claims for unpaid wages, overtime, and all of those other issues, which were reasonably related to the Washington Minimum Wage Act overtime requirement. So that's dealing solely with the issue of the mispayment of wages.
Well, that can't be right. And look at it again, because earlier in the statute makes reference to the things other than the kind of... You're reading this narrowing portion after a language or before Washington's Department of Labor and Industries. But earlier, it uses the very broad in connection with employment of Praxair and makes reference, for example, to the federal statute. So I don't know that you can take, and I'm pretty confident that you can't take this language that you're reading here later related to and act as if it modifies the whole paragraph. It just doesn't make any sense that way, does it?
I believe that it does. I believe that it clearly indicates when you look at the text of that and dealing with the release earlier in the document where it says...
If you wanted to say that, I mean, if you wanted to say you are... Here's what you waive and release. You waive and release anything to do with wages or hours of work, including such and such. But unfortunately, it doesn't say that. It says in two places, it says that you release any claim, any and all claims under federal or state law. And then if we move to the language you referenced earlier, at the end of the agreement, it says, plaintiff fully understands the terms of the settlement agreement and voluntarily accepts them in full and final settlement of the lawsuit. And any claims which could have been brought up in public passage. So, both of those say any claims.
But the primary language dealing with the operation of the release indicates that it is related to wages or hours of work.
Let me ask you this. What does this mean to you, these words? Including but not limited to. What do you think that means?
It means it is including all claims that are related to hours. First, you've got to go to including. Let me just find the language. Any and all claims, liabilities, or obligations he has, which might have arisen out of or in connection with plaintiff's employment at Praxair, whether based on state or federal common law, including but not limited to the common law statute, Washington Minimum Wage Act, related to wages or hours of work.
And if you were trying to limit, draft a release that was limited to wages or hours of work, why would a phrase like might have arisen out of or in connection with plaintiff's employment at Praxair, including but not limited to? I mean, the modifier, the descriptor, limited to wages, would never come at the end of that. It'd have to come at the beginning. What comes at the beginning is I'm releasing everything having to do with my employment. Isn't that how it's ordinarily read?
Well, again, I go back to the introductory language where the parties desire to enter into the settlement agreement for any and all claims which have or might have been brought against Praxair regarding alleged unpaid wages and or overtime. So it is at
where
the beginning.
Reading, where are you reading from?
This is on page 73. It's recited at page 24 of my brief. And it is paragraph C of the recitals. And so the recitals indicates that it is regarding unpaid wages and or overtime occurring as a result of the plaintiff's employment during the dates alleged.
Well, that was the grade of the underlying case, right?
Yes.
Okay. But isn't it, I presume that you've been practicing for a while, isn't it typical in settling lawsuits, in order to buy their peace, the settling party, that is the party that is going to hang somebody or do something, normally doesn't want to have to come back to court at some later time and have to deal with these same parties again, having to do with peripheral issues, even issues that they may not be aware of. And so while in the settlement agreement, the specific litigation may be highlighted, in this settlement agreement, it would appear the language which Judge Clifton and Judge McEwen have read to you a number of times, that they intended a global settlement of all issues going and unknown. When they use the language that says, but not limited to, which was precisely what Judge McEwen was asking here, they were intending to basically buy their peace, were they not?
That may have been the intent of Praxair, but the intent of the other parties.
They signed it. They signed this document. They signed it. Even they were represented by counsel, they weren't by themselves walking around there as pro ses, were they?
No, they were represented by different counsel in the execution of the settlement document.
Were they represented? Does the record reflect whether in the union grievance they were represented as counsel?
They were represented by counsel for the union in the union grievance.
And was that a separate counsel than the person who represented them in the larger lawsuit over wages and hours?
To be honest, I don't know.
I mean, what's happened, I think, is unfortunate in that to the extent that your client thought that they still have a case, they signed, with advice of counsel, they signed this release agreement. So our charge as the court, of course, is to determine the legal effect of that. And it may be that they had hoped, obviously they wouldn't have filed their third lawsuit if they thought they didn't have one. I mean, I don't think they would have, you know, done that if they honestly didn't believe they had one. The question then becomes, having filed the third lawsuit, which is over the same subject as the first lawsuit, but with, as you point out, a different moniker of public policy.
And different remedies that are
and different remedies that they would get in federal court.
State court.
Well, yeah, they got moved under the various statutes. I guess the question we have is whether this release, if they're properly in federal court under removal, then, you know, was it a proper interpretation? The one thing that you didn't respond to in that regard is you addressed the word including various wage and hour claims. But that phrase actually has something that's very, as you know, typical in release agreements. It's including but not limited to. And would you agree that that typically means that the listing of specific items is not the universe of what's released? It's not the universe of what the general release language attaches to.
I would agree that that is correct. However, I don't believe that the language can be read without the specific language at the end that discusses that it is related to all claims related to wages or hours of work. And the language in terms of the release that they were directed to issue in the underlying court was also a release as to the claims of the wages and hours. It was the release agreement called for them to issue a very limited release or stipulated order of dismissal with prejudice of the underlying action related to wages and hours work.
Well, they could have just dismissed the action with prejudice, and if the settlement was intended to do no more than dispose of the previous litigation, that would have ended it, wouldn't it? I mean, sometimes you don't have a separate release agreement. You simply dismiss the pending action with prejudice. That extinguishes the claim that was brought there, but it doesn't extinguish other claims that might exist in most cases. But here they signed a separate release agreement that had broader language. I mean, that's really the problem I've had trying to figure out why it is that something should be carved out in the face of this terminology in the settlement agreement. What's so unique or different about the claim they're trying to bring now that it shouldn't be covered here?
Well, there's nothing unique or different about the claim that they're bringing now, but that it is not related to wages and hours of work. It's a retaliatory discharge case, and that the release, in the context of the dealings of the parties, the release is limited to those wage and hour claims, which were brought by Mr. Atkins, Mr. Peel, and several other employees, is reflected in the release document.
You have kind of overextended your time, but I'll give you some time for rebuttals.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Catherine Morissette, and I represent Appellant Praxair, Inc. The relevant issue in this case is not what Mr. Atkins and Mr. Peel might have, could have, or should have alleged in their complaint, or might have, could have, or should have signed in the settlement agreement. First off, we want to look at their actual factual allegations in the complaint and the actual claims that they alleged in the complaint. Plaintiffs have said that they are bringing their claims based on a different legal theory. At essence, their claims are for unjust termination. And if we look at the complaint in this case, we see that they alleged breach of the union contract. Specifically, they referred to the union contract over 5 times in the allegations in their complaint. The complaint is found at Excerpt of Record, page 2. Paragraphs 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15 of that complaint all refer to breach in terms of condition of the union contract. These on their face are claims that arise under Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act. It's for this reason that Praxair removed the case to federal court. Plaintiffs specifically alleged that they were seeking to enforce their union contract rights in the complaint. They titled their claim for wrongful termination, breach of the employment contract. We're here because they're taking a stab at post-removal artful pleading to come up with a breach of employment policy claim that also survives preemption. Even if the court allows plaintiffs to abandon their union contract claims, resolving whether their termination violated public policy is also going to depend on interpretation of the union contract. The terms of the union contract are inextricably intertwined with any determination of whether plaintiff's termination was justified in this case. We're not just going to look to the CBA to figure out a rate of pay for purposes of calculating damages. We're going to have to look to the CBA to figure out what various terms mean and whether, in fact, as plaintiffs have alleged and also testified to previously, they were paying themselves correctly under the terms of the agreement. in the record are a couple pages from their deposition transcript where they said that they believe their payroll entries were correct based on their own interpretation of tour of duty in the union contract. You can find that at excerpt of record 99 and 101. This puts the case squarely within the Firestone case. In Firestone, the employees had asserted a state law overtime claim, but state law in that case exempted the employees from overtime where they received premium pay. So to hear, Washington law actually exempts truck drivers who are paid the reasonable equivalent of overtime. That's why we have a union contract in this case that allows for various different types of pay, pay rates, mileage rates, hourly rates, fill pay, minimum time worked, and so forth. That's probably
the same. They do mention the union contract on a number of occasions. They also claim that if they were terminated because they were exercising Washington minimum wage rights under the state statute, that that also would be a violation of public policy. Can that be segregated from the collective bargaining agreement and brought as an independent claim?
Not on the facts in this record or the actual facts in this case. I would agree with the hypothetical situation that an employee covered by a collective bargaining agreement could go into their boss and say, hey, the collective bargaining agreement says that I only get overtime after I've worked 50 hours a week, but state law says I'm supposed to get overtime after 40 hours a week. And the manager could tell him to pound sand and terminate him. I think we'd have a clear wrongful discharge in violation of state public policy that survives preemption that has nothing to do with the union agreement. Here it's different for the reasons that I stated earlier, which is that determining whether even they were paying themselves correctly under the collective bargaining agreement or whether they even had a minimum wage act right in the first place is going to depend on interpreting terms of the agreement. The second thing I would point out to the court is that the record is devoid here of any evidence of what their protected conduct is other than two things. One, we can assume from the face of the complaint they're referring to somehow that making these payroll entries that they believed were correct under Washington law was a protected activity and they were retaliated for doing that. I believe, and I think that there's going to be no case that says an employee's remedy, if they think they're not being paid their full wages, is to reach in the till and grab the extra cash to take home that day. Washington law is clear that they have a wage and hour action, that they'll get their attorney's fees, and that they'll even get a double wage penalty if they prevail. That's, in fact, exactly what the intervening lawsuit is here, or what I'll call Praxair 1. That's what the issues that were addressed already in that case. So I don't think there's... The second thing that we have in the record is the fact that they filed the first wage and hour case to begin with, but that happened after they were terminated. There's no temporal connection there that the termination can have to do with the fact that they filed the lawsuit, because the lawsuit was filed a month after they were terminated for the false payroll entries. Because all of their claims in this case arise under Section 301, they're barred by the applicable statute of limitations, which is 6 months. This current claim was brought 10 months after they received the arbitrator's decision. Second, we have, as the court is aware, there's a threshold showing to bring a Section 301 claim that the union breached its duty of fair representation. There's no allegation, nor is there any evidence into the record that was the case here. The last subject that I'll turn to is the settlement agreement and release, which you spent some time with opposing counsel on. The court can reach that issue based on its discretion to exercise supplemental jurisdiction, because it's clear that the complaint has alleged straight-out breach of the union contract claims that clearly arise under 301. If we look at the settlement agreement, what plaintiffs want to do is move the phrase related to wages or hours of work up before the including but not limited to clause. That's how they want it to be read. That's not how it reads, and that's not the agreement that they signed. And as the court has already pointed out, even if there were any confusion about what that phrase means, and I would posit that there is not, it's clear by the bold, all caps, paragraph right before their signature that plaintiffs released all claims which could have been brought prior to the signing of that agreement. This case is really about the fact that Mr. Atkins and Mr. Peel are unhappy that they didn't get any monetary award in the arbitration.
Yes, you had said that in your view the statute of limitations is 6 months?
Correct, under Del Costello.
That's what the district court, I think, also found. Is that based on a reference back to a Washington statute, since there's not a federal statute of limitations?
I know that the court has also said in other instances that we look to what Washington would apply in decisions to uphold arbitrations, and I believe that is 6 months as well. I can give the court.
There's a Washington Code 7.4, which is a 3 months, and I'm just curious as to why some of these are analyzed under 3 months and some are analyzed under 6 months.
I think that you'll see some cases that say we'll borrow from the Washington State statute, the state statute of limitations as it applies to arbitration, and some cases that apply the six-month standard under Del Costello. I did argue that in the briefs to the district court, that 3 months or 6 months were past either of them. So really the answer is they're borrowed by the statute of limitations, whichever standard that you're going to apply. Was speaking about the consequences of the arbitration, and I know that counsel's brought up the point, well, because the arbitrator found that there was no just cause for termination, that somehow should apply in this case, and we win and get our money now. That's a collateral estoppel issue, not a res judicata issue. The arbitrator did not reach the issue of whether or not the payroll entries were proper under Washington law. The arbitrator applied a very high standard for Praxair to meet, which was could Praxair and did Praxair prove actual criminal intent to steal. The arbitrator even used the phrase mens rea and used the phrase criminal conduct. That's a different standard and a totally different issue than what would be relevant in this case. I also would point out that the arbitrator, as the court has noted, was clearly bothered by Mr. Atkins and Mr. Peel's conduct. He made the comment about them being evasive and also said that they should be held accountable for the payroll honor system and the trust that Praxair places in its employees to make their payroll entries correct. Unless the court has any further questions.
I think not. Thank you.
Yeah.
We have an additional minute for rebuttal.
The plaintiff's complaint in paragraph 15, page 2 of the record, states defendant's conduct in terminating plaintiff because they sought to enforce both their union contract rights and the Washington State minimum wage rights is a violation of public policy and is actionable as such. I mean, that's what they're alleging in their complaint. What they alleged in their complaint, I believe I heard counsel in argument say, if we're dealing with a public policy claim, then it is not preempted, and they can go forward with their public policy claim. Brings us back around to the release, and I would submit that the release is set up limiting it both in the introductory recital, that it's limited to the wage and hour claims, that the actual operational language, including but not limited to, is limited to the wage and hour claims, that the language in the release that specifies that the dismissal that will be entered in court is only of the claims which are a part of this lawsuit, and that it was specifically intended as a limited release, and it should be enforced as such. If not, there is ambiguity with regard to the intent of the parties. The release is analyzed under Washington law, and Washington views the intent of the parties from the context. And clearly, there is some ambiguity there that creates questions of fact that renders summary judgment inappropriate.
Thank you. Thank you both counsel for your argument this morning. The case of Adkins versus Praxair is submitted.